From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, selling the family farm to make a record, we talk with Freddy Johnston. The album he made with the money from the farm has been called a perfect album, and it ended up on a lot of 10 best lists. We'll hear some of his new EP, and he'll perform for us. Also today, actress Angela Bassett on portraying Tina Turner in the new movie What's Love Got to Do with It? And TV critic David Bianculli on the return of the documentary series CBS Reports. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge has ruled that the Clinton administration must complete an environmental impact statement before submitting the North American Free Trade Agreement to Congress, NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
In issuing his ruling, federal judge Charles Ritchie cited the National Environmental Policy Act. That law requires the federal government to prepare an environmental impact statement for every action significantly affecting the quality of the human environment. Traditionally, trade agreements have not included such impact statements, but Judge Ritchie ruled today that one is needed to assess the present and future environmental consequences of NAFTA. Today's ruling comes in response to a lawsuit filed by three environmental groups opposed to the free trade agreement. NAFTA was reached last October by the Bush administration, but the Clinton administration has been busy trying to craft side agreements that protect the environment and safeguard U.S. jobs. Asked if today's ruling will slow down that process, one former U.S. trade official said, "I don't know how it can get any slower." This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
President Clinton's plan to solve the conflict between loggers and environmentalists in the Northwest would reportedly provide more than $1 billion to offset cuts in timber harvests. Administration officials told reporters that the plan would reduce the annual timber harvest in the region to about a third of the high levels reached in the 1980s. The president is to announce the plan tomorrow morning in a news conference with Vice President Al Gore. The administration is under a federal court order to come up with a plan to protect the northern spotted owl in the region's old-growth forest by July 16th. A federal judge in Cincinnati ruled today that the government hindered the defense in the deportation of John Demjanjuk by withholding evidence. Demjanjuk was later convicted in Israel of being a guard in a Nazi death camp. Steve Hirschberg of member station WVXU in Cincinnati reports.
In his report to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Thomas Wiseman of Nashville, Tennessee, said the Justice Department withheld evidence showing Ivan Marchenko, not John Demjanjuk, may have been the Treblinka death camp guard known as Ivan the Terrible. Wiseman says government prosecutors committed fraud, but they did so without intending to violate any rules or ethical obligations. The judge recommends that the appeals court in Cincinnati close the Demjanjuk case, and that no action be taken against government attorneys who prosecuted the former Cleveland auto worker. The federal appeals court, which has been trying to decide whether Demjanjuk's extradition to Israel was proper, will have the final say in the case. The court will allow both sides to file objections to Wiseman's report and recommendations. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Hirschberg in Cincinnati.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points to close at 3,516. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. The International Monetary Fund has approved a $1.5 billion loan for Russia. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen called the vote a strong endorsement of the Russian government's reform program and a vote of confidence for President Boris Yeltsin. A senior UN official said there's no evidence to substantiate reports that Iraq has a secret nuclear reactor. The UN chief nuclear inspector in Iraq said it would be possible for Iraqi scientists to resume their nuclear operations, but they'd have to start from scratch because most of their equipment has been destroyed. From Baghdad, the BBC's Jeremy Bowen reports.
As he left Baghdad, the chief inspector, Bob Kelly, said they'd met most of their goals and made up most of the time they'd lost because of the military action at the weekend. Mr. Kelly said it was time to lay to rest reports that the Iraqis have a nuclear reactor.
Having looked at these data for 2 years now, and have looked at everything that's available, I think it's time to put it on the back burner We can reopen it if anything new comes up, but there is no reason at this point to believe there's a reactor in Iraq, and frankly, there never was any really good evidence there was in the first place.
Mr. Kelly went on to say that he'd still like to know the names of the suppliers and middlemen who'd made Iraq's nuclear program possible before the Gulf War. That, he said, would remove any lingering doubts that the Iraqis were restarting their nuclear enterprise.
Jeremy Bowen reporting from Baghdad. Two former Army reservists told a Senate panel today that their units were attacked with chemical weapons during the Persian Gulf War. The two men said they were ordered to keep quiet about the attack, which they said took place in January of 1991 near the Saudi port of Al Jubail on the Persian Gulf. The men, Sterling Sims and Willie Hicks, said 85 of the 110 soldiers in their unit at the time now suffer from medical problems, and one of those soldiers has died. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you don't keep up with pop music, you may not yet be familiar with the work of my guest, Freddy Johnston. There's been no shortage of praise for his work. Last year, our rock critic Ken Tucker included Johnston's album Can You Fly on his end-of-the-year top 10 list. So did music critics in the New York Times, Spin, and People. Critic Robert Christgau called Can You Fly a perfect album, a study in bringing confusion under control and in loving your life as a beautiful mess. We invited Johnston to talk with us from the NPR Bureau in New York, and to our surprise, he brought his guitar. But let's start with one of his recordings. This is his song, The Lucky One, featured both on his album Can You Fly and his new EP, Unlucky.
Walking from the bus stop, couldn't wait to get off. I know I am the lucky one. Walking through the twilight, cold Nevada twilight.
Johnston, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Who is this song about?
The Lucky One is, it's not about any one person. It was inspired by a trip I took to Las Vegas a couple years ago. It showed up about midnight or 1 a.m. on this hot summer night and saw all these guys walking to and from the downtown casinos. Just, you know, I don't know. I didn't expect to see that, these sort of walking dead zombies going from one slot machine bank to the next. And it was very sad.
Well, here's what I was wondering, that, you know, when you left your home and went to New York and hoped to make it as a songwriter, I bet a lot of people said to you, oh, no, only the lucky ones make it, and very few people make it. And you'll
well,
make
now
it.
That's a very interesting angle on that. I've never thought about that at all. But that's true. And I'm sure that I said that to myself many times.
That you know that, you'd be the lucky one?
No, that a lot of people make it, and that, and that you know, fat chance, kid. But I've never put that spin on that song.
You grew up in a small town named Kinsley, Kansas. Would you describe the town for us?
Well, it's a small town, about 2,500 people, out on the western Kansas prairie, There's not a lot going on there. There's one movie theater. At least last time I was there, there was a movie theater and a couple bars. But no real, I guess, I don't know. It's not the cultural center of the world or even of Kansas. So it was a little slow. I ended up driving around in my friend's car since I didn't drive. Driving around with my friends when I was an adolescent, just listening to tapes and causing trouble. That was my life there.
What kind of tapes and what kind of trouble?
I was so... Next question. No, I listen to a lot of mid-70s heavy metal, to be honest. It doesn't completely come through in my music.
It sure doesn't.
At all. But I'm still a pretty big Led Zeppelin fan and Aerosmith and Cheap Trick and all that stuff. That's those are my roots, Terry. It seems to me, David Bowie. It was only later when I started listening to different kinds of music. And now I listen to everything.
How come you seem to be in the singer-songwriter tradition of rock, and your musical listening roots are in the heavy metal tradition?
Well, I've thought about that a bit, obviously, because it is pretty strange. I guess it comes from playing acoustic guitar. I bought an acoustic guitar when I was 16. I ordered it through UPS from some distributor on the East Coast because there wasn't a music store in town. But when I started playing acoustic guitar, you just end up writing folky type music because of the nature of the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't very well do heavy metal ballads on my acoustic guitar. So I think it comes from me playing acoustic guitar. It's the influence of the instrument more so than the music.
You have your guitar with you.
Yeah, I do.
Would you play us a chorus of something that was very important to you when you first started to play?
When I first started to play?
Yeah.
Well, I could completely humiliate myself and play you a bit of a joke song that I first wrote.
Please.
Do you really want to hear that?
Yes.
This is not a joke program, but when I was 18, there was a senior class talent show, and I wrote a song for that. It ended up being kind of a kid's song, but it was the first song I ever wrote. And it's called Sparky the Heroic Dog. Do you want to hear a little bit of that?
Absolutely.
Sparky the Heroic Dog, save my life one night when the house burned down. Sparky the Heroic Dog became a hero back in my hometown. Oh, Sparky. And there's a sad part. Do you want to hear that too?
Sure, sure.
Sparky, my dog, was so warm and soft and brought my pipe and slippers when I came home from work each night. You can tell I was just learning how to write songs. I had too many words in that line. He smelled when he was wet, but I loved Sparky yet. A primitive rhyme. Sparky. There you go.
What kind of reaction did you get at the talent contest?
It was uproarious because there were a lot of kids in the audience, so the kids loved it. But that was, I guess, I have no self-respect whatsoever. There it is. That's because I just did that on National Public Radio, Terry. But that's the first song I ever wrote. It's not really my roots or where I come from, but it is the first song I ever wrote.
Let me go back to something you were saying earlier. You said that you would drive around in friends' cars listening to tapes and getting into trouble. So now we should get to the trouble part.
Well, there wasn't a lot to do. You would basically kind of drive around in a circle from Main Street back up to the highway and then around. It was a circuit of town, and that's kind of what you would do for fun. It's a pretty limited, fairly limited options of what to do in Kinsley, Kansas when you're a kid. But I didn't cause that much trouble, I guess. I lived in a smaller town. It's too complicated of a story to get into, but I lived in a smaller town nearby for a time, and that's when I got into trouble, an even smaller town of 100 people.
Trouble for doing what?
Just, there's nothing to do there, and you turn into a vandal. So, I say one turns into a vandal. And
that's absolving yourself of responsibility.
Exactly. I don't know, just causing trouble. And, in retrospect, it's not completely, I wasn't a felon or anything. But it was out of frustration or out of boredom is what it was.
Freddie Johnston is my guest. He has a new EP called Unlucky. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with singer-songwriter Freddie Johnston. Freddie, how did you get out of Kansas and go to New York?
How did I get out? Well, one dark night when the moon was down, I dug a hole under the fence and took a handkerchief with a pocket knife and some dried bread and ran for the border. But in reality, no, I actually took the bus from Lawrence, Kansas one day and came to New York City and moved in with a friend who had a spare couch and started, this is about in 85, 86, and started looking for a job and I guess starting over.
How did you try to get people to hear your songs in New York? I'm assuming that you already had the idea that you wanted to record.
Well, I was fairly unambitious, I guess. It took me a long time to play my songs for anyone. And even after that, I didn't actively promote myself or try to get a band together. When I look back, I wish I had done that. That's the way to go. It didn't happen that way for me. But that's a reason why, perhaps about why it took me so long.
So
I'm now 32, and I guess I've been writing songs for about 10 years. So it's taken me a while. But when I came here, I didn't get a band together. I just worked with my four track in my apartment, and it took the intervention of friends to get me to do it, to distribute a tape and things like that.
Did you try to perform in clubs?
I only performed here after I had a record deal with Barnen Records.
That's odd because it's usually the other way around. You perform clubs, you know, where you live and try to get some other gigs nearby, and then finally somebody hears you and you get a record, but you usually have a lot of performing under your belt by the time you've recorded.
You usually do. I went about it completely backwards. I'm lucky that I was able to get up on stage and wasn't afraid to make a fool of myself or be a ham. So I didn't have a lot of trouble. I had done half a dozen gigs or so before The Trouble Tree came out, my first record, so I wasn't a seasoned road dog at all, but I was able to play, I was able to bring it across.
How did you get a tape to the record company Bar None that first signed you?
I actually didn't do it. It was a friend of mine, a writer friend named Michael Azarad. He heard a tape, actually through his wife, who worked with my cousin at the New Yorker magazine. It's a long story, but she had a tape and gave it to him, and then he liked it and began distributing it. And one day Barnum called me up, and the rest is the rest.
So if somebody hadn't taken action on your behalf, maybe nothing would have happened.
I don't know if it would have happened at that rate. No, I fully admit that. I was not promoting myself.
For someone who's been pretty unambitious and not at all into, you know, selling himself, especially, you know, when you were first getting started, you did something that I think really indicates a great kind of belief in your music. And what I'm thinking of is when you sold the family farm to raise money to finish production on your first album.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what happened.
I don't like to admit it, even though I end up talking about it all the time. I don't like to really use it as a promotional tool, that topic, because it still bothers me that I had to do that. It was the right decision. I don't regret it, but it was a difficult one. It was inherited farmland, inherited from my grandfather, and it was my only real asset at the time of making the album, and we ran out of cash. The record company ran out of cash, and yet the record had to be finished. So I liquidated the land, and the gamble paid off. But I guess getting back to the lucky one there,
mm-hmm,
the gamble paid off. Had it not paid off, I don't know where I would be. I don't know where I'd... it's not that I don't know where I'd be, but I don't know how I'd be feeling right now. I would probably be very depressed if I had sold that precious land and then the record had been panned or slagged or ignored or not even come out. So I rolled the dice and won, and I'm not really a gambling person. I when I went to Las Vegas, I gambled $1.50. So it's not in my nature to do that. Someday there's I have a dream of buying back the land. Mm-hmm. I know the man who bought it mm-hmm. fairly well, so that is a possibility. The problem with selling land mainly was that it contained the house that I had lived in when the first house I lived in. So I didn't really want to sell that. And at least I could buy back the house someday to make up for it. That would actually be a fitting conclusion to the story, selling the land and then being that enabling me to eventually buy it back. But that's the story, and the first song on the album kind of is about that.
Yeah, why don't we play that? The song is called "Trying to Tell You I Don't Know," and do you want to say something about when you wrote this and how you wrote it?
Well, it was written. It was one of the last songs when we were making the album. It was one of the last songs that I finished. It was an angry song, and I hadn't intended it to be part of the record, but it ended up making it, and it's ironic that it's a song about the making of the record.
Why don't we hear it? Trying to Tell You I Don't Know, Freddie Johnston, and it's from his album Can You Fly. How did the rest of your family react when you sold the farm?
It was kind of a secret for a while. I was ashamed. It was my decision. It was my brother and I jointly owned the land, so it was our decision. But I didn't want to talk about it. I still haven't really. I honestly haven't spoken to my mother about it directly. It's an open. I mean, it's a known topic, but I've kept it to myself. I just don't like to talk about it to them, because I think that if my grandfather would have been alive, or my father had been alive to see me commit that act, it would have just been unbelievable to them. The height of folly to sell this thing that you can see and measure and use and that is producing a yearly income from a wheat crop, this real estate, to sell that to finish making a rock record that maybe or maybe not is gonna maybe do something, possibly, perhaps. they wouldn't have been able to believe it.
Can I ask you about your name, Freddie? That's a nickname?
It's a nickname, actually. It's I streamlined the story that my mother gave it to me. It's actually a friend of my mother's named Leela, gave me the name years ago when I was about, I don't know, 14 or 15. It was a mispronunciation of Freddie. And my mother made the name happen. She just, she wouldn't let it go. She called me Freddie all the time because she thought it was so hilarious. And she still calls me Freddie. She calls me Freed, actually.
There was a bar in the place you grew up called the Trouble Tree.
The Trouble Tree, yeah.
Yeah, can you tell us about the bar and play a chorus of the song you wrote about it?
Really? Okay. The Trouble Tree, that was named by my mother as well, just like I was. It's closed now, sadly. It was called the Rain Tree Lounge, and it was a little bar downtown. It was actually, the Kansas alcohol laws have changed since, but it used to be that in order to sell hard liquor, you had to be a private club, and you had to be a member to go in there. Anyway, this was a private club, and it was on the weekend nights, all hell would break loose. I don't know why, but my mother renamed it from the Rain Tree to the Trouble Tree, and I wrote a little ditty about it, which I never played for my mother because I was so embarrassed, but she eventually heard it. Do you want to hear a little of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
up in the trouble tree, drinking with Leela's ex, up in the trouble tree, fighting with Mexicans. Never been to New York, got a brother in Galveston. Been to the trouble tree, up there more than once. I'm shaking like a leaf. He looks like a very bad fruit. He's rotten through with grief, falling out of the trouble tree. Not the best take there, but...
I thought it sounded really good.
Okay. I've always worried about the line about fighting with Mexicans. I don't want that to be misinterpreted. That's just kind of what happened. A lot of farm workers from Mexico would come up, as far as Kansas, obviously, and they would be drinking on a weekend night, and there would be scuffles just all the time. It was kind of comical in a way, although I'm sure to be involved in them, it wasn't comical. And then the Leela's ex line, I might as well, since I'm on national radio, that was the woman, the Leela, who actually gave me my nickname, her ex-husband put on the front of his pickup in big stick-on letters after he divorced her, Leela's ex. And so you'd always see that truck sitting down at the trouble tree. And, it's just too much.
I'm going to say something that I never thought I'd ever say to anyone, which is I like your version of Wichita Lineman.
You do, really?
I mean, this is with no offense to Glenn Campbell, who had the hit, or to
Jimmy Webb, who wrote
Jimmy
the song.
Webb, yeah. Who wrote it. It's a song I have always, it came on the radio, I was on another station.
Yeah, right.
Is it the Kansas connection that inspired you to sing it? Like, what inspired you to sing this song?
You know, I hadn't thought about that when we recorded it and decided to put it on the EP. I didn't think that there would be the obvious Kansas connection, if you can believe that, because mm-hmm. I had known all along that the song was written about Wichita Falls, Texas.
Oh.
So that was something.
Oh, I assumed it was Wichita, Kansas.
So I slipped up. I didn't even think about it, but obviously people are going to assume that that's why I covered it.
Well, I want to play it.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah. And this is Freddie Johnston's recording of Wichita Lineman from his new EP, Unlucky.
I am a lineman for the county, and I ride the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wires, I hear you through the wine, and the Wichita lineman is still on the line. You know I need a short vacation.
Freddie Johnston's new EP, Unlucky, is on Bar None Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
And if it snows that stretch down south, we'll never take the strain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Angela Bassett played a career woman with a troubled teenage son in Boys in the Hood. And in Malcolm X, she played Betty Shabazz, the wife of the great leader. Both roles are a far cry from the sexy, hard-driving singer she's portraying now. Coming up, Angela Bassett tells us about playing Tina Turner in the new movie What's Love Got to Do with It? And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Schwarzkopf in Vietnam, the first documentary in the revived series CBS Reports. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The FBI says a night suspect has been arrested in connection with an alleged plot to blow up several sites in New York City. Officials say the latest suspect was arrested in Philadelphia and charged with conspiracy to transport explosives and interstate commerce. Eight other people were arrested last week in New York and charged with conspiracy to bomb the UN, the building that houses FBI offices in New York, and two tunnels underneath the Hudson River. They are being held without bail. As President Clinton prepares for an upcoming economic summit meeting in Japan, he is laying out what he wants the other industrialized nations to do in order to stimulate world economic growth. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president said he'd like Japan to stimulate its economy and open its markets. He wants the Europeans to resolve their differences on agricultural subsidies so that a world trade agreement can be signed. And he wants the German central bank to lower interest rates. But that wish list may be little more than wishful thinking. Administration officials say that the recent defeat of Japanese Prime Minister Kaiichi Miyazawa will make it almost impossible to reach agreements on trade with the shaky Japanese government. And Germany's resistance to increasing its budget deficit or risking higher inflation will make it difficult to get the Germans to agree to boost growth. White House officials are also lowering expectations for another one of the president's goals for the summit, a Western privatization fund to help convert Russian industry. Originally set at $4 billion, it's now expected to reach only $1.5 billion. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Bosnia, after an uneasy truce, fighting has broken out again between Croatian and Muslim forces in the southern city of Mostar. The commander of Croatian forces has ordered a general mobilization of all those between the ages of 18 and 60. NPR's Ann Gerrels in Split has more on the story.
Even though the Muslims launched today's attack, UN officials leave little doubt they blame the Bosnian Croats for creating the situation which led to today's fighting. The germ of the problem is that Bosnian Croats do not want to share power or even tolerate the presence of Muslims in this area, which they hope will be eventually assigned to Croats under any future peace plan. After Muslim refugees began to flood the city, upsetting the delicate ethnic balance, Bosnian Croat forces push Muslim troops and civilians into the eastern part. For 2 months, they have had almost no fresh water and limited food. The Bosnian Croats did not permit the UN to enter the city today, and despite today's Muslim victory, a UN official called this an act of desperation, which is unlikely to succeed in the long run. I'm Ann Gerrels in Split.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 3 points to close at 3,516.08, on volume of 281 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the House has voted to keep the Hyde Amendment barring federal funding for abortions. The vote of 255 to 178 came as the House debated a money bill for the Department of Health and Human Services. The measure bars the use of Medicaid funding to pay for abortions for poor women, except in certain cases. The measure has been added to the appropriations bill for the last 16 years. A report on the quality of beaches around the United States has found that the water at more than 2,000 beaches was polluted last year. And the report by the Natural Resources Defense Council found 8 beaches closed permanently, as well as an increase in the number of dirty beaches overall. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
Beaches become unsafe when their waters are contaminated by high levels of bacteria found in human and animal waste. The contamination comes from overloaded sewage treatment plants, from seeping septic systems, and waste from boats. The germs can cause hepatitis, gastroenteritis, and a variety of rashes and fevers. Bob Adler is a spokesman for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says part of the problem is that 8 of the 22 coastal states don't monitor their beaches at all.
Congress should require EPA to establish minimum uniform testing, monitoring, and bacteria and other pathogen standards so that the public around the country receives equal protection against beach pollution.
Congress is now considering a revision of the Clean Water Act, which would tighten coastal pollution standards. This is Philip Davis in Washington.
The government says that factory orders have gone down again for the third month in a row. The Commerce Department says that factory orders declined in May by 1.4%. It was the first time in more than 2 years that factory orders had three straight months in a row in declines. A backlog of unfilled orders also went down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
You must understand the touch of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill. Boy meeting girl, opposites attract. It's physical, only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more than.
Tina Turner is convincingly portrayed by Angela Bassett in the new film What's Love Got to Do With It. Based on Turner's autobiography, the movie tells the story of how Tina was discovered by Ike Turner, who married her and made her the star of his Rhythm and Blues Review. What their fans didn't know is that Ike used to beat Tina. Angela Bassett also starred in the film Malcolm X as Malcolm's wife, Betty Shabazz. In Boys in the Hood, she played a working woman with a troubled teenage son. The part of her ex-husband was played by Larry Fishburne, who plays Ike Turner in the new film. When I first heard about What's Love Got to Do With It, I assumed it was going to be a made-for-TV movie. Bassett told me she was concerned about whether this would be a serious treatment of Tina Turner's life.
I was concerned, you know, initially, because, I mean, she's such an icon, you know, so well-known, you know, has such a trademark, the lips, the legs, the shimmy, the shake, the hair. And you wonder, of course, I did. I had such concern. And I also had read the autobiography, so I knew the relationship between Ike and herself. And I wondered how seriously it would be taken with how much care and consideration, with how much class mm-hmm. it would be done.
Just judging from your previous film roles, at least the ones I'd seen, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have thought that you would be the first choice for Tina Turner. You don't yeah. physically look like her in your other films.
Yeah.
And the roles mm-hmm. that you played in the past weren't anything like what's required for Tina Turner. What did you mm-hmm. do at the audition to convince the people who were judging you that you could play Tina Turner?
I think it was the emotional honesty that I brought to the role. There was one particular scene where, you know, he drags her down the hallway, you know, in front of the children, and it's the first time you see the physical abuse that's going on. And in that particular audition, in an audition process, it's so unnatural, you know, anyway. You're oftentimes not reading with an actor. You're oftentimes, maybe you've infused and informed it with a, you know, a lot of life and the history of the character, et cetera, but you're reading with, you know, someone who's not an acting professional, and they're just reading lines to you, and yet you have to react as if, you know, it's really happening then and there. Sometimes you can do too, it seems like too much, that's because they're doing nothing. But I was able to really go to that emotional depth and honesty that was required. And I think that they hadn't seen that up to that point, you know. And he couldn't hit me or drag me or do anything to me like that, you know, in the audition process. But I behaved as if it were happening.
So, the casting director who was dragging you down?
Yeah, it was the casting director, but he didn't drag me. He just made a step toward me.
Uh-huh.
Because he's not going to drag me. It's not planned. It's a stunt, you know? He's not going to hit me. He's not going to act as if he's going to hit me, but the only thing he can do is maybe shift his chair or move his hand toward me or something. But I was, what you saw in the movie is what I did in the audition.
Once you got the part, how much time did you spend with Tina Turner?
I spent maybe about 3 hours with her before I got the part.
Before you got screen tested.
Yeah. Yes, I had an opportunity to meet her before I screen tested.
How did you arrange that?
The director asked me if I wanted to meet her because she was in town she was in L.A. putting down the rough mixes for the movie because mm-hmm. She was going to sing it. So the actor did not have to sing the role. You didn't have to sing like Tina Turner, you know? So I had about 3 hours with her at the studio, and, you know, she met me to okay me or whatever, you know, and she liked me when she saw me. And at that point, I think her manager had seen some of the other work I've done, you know, Malcolm and I don't think the Jacksons were out at that time, but Passion Fish, City of Hope, couple other projects that I've been involved in. So they were aware of my work. And then when she met me in person, you know, she thought she liked, you know, my energy and my way and my spirit. And she's very kind and gracious herself. And she just embraced me and okayed me, you know, sanctioned me.
And did you meet with her more after you got the part?
After I got the part, I met her for about an hour. She came to, you know, go over the makeup with the makeup artist and myself, but I was working out so hard and so fastidiously. I mean that I was sore, and it was the first time that I visited a chiropractor in my life. Because if you can imagine, you know, when you just start working out, you know, you're working muscles you never worked before, you know, it takes about 4 or 5 days for them to, you know, just to ease up and you can get into the groove. But I had no time to ease up. I had to, you know, learn spend about 6-7 hours, you know, learning the choreography and yet working out every day also. So I was my body was just in a great deal of pain then. So I had to go to the chiropractor. I just couldn't make it through some days. So I spent a few moments with her then and went over a few songs and, you know, just playing around in the mirror, singing, watching her energy, watching her work as we videotaped her during the steps for us.
My guest is Angela Bassett. She plays Tina Turner in the new film, What's Love Got to Do With It? More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Angela Bassett. There are several performance scenes with you on stage, and as we all know, Tina Turner is a very physical performer. Were you ever a dancer? Are you uninhibited even at a party where there's dance music on?
No, I'm not a dancer. My training isn't musical theater. You know, I went to Yale School of Drama, and it's strictly conservatory. So we may have movement classes, but that's fencing, you know. So that's that world. I lived in New York for about 6.5 years, and the circle that I traveled in was so different from the, you know, dream girls, you know, and, you know, the musical theater circle. I didn't even know those artists. I knew of them, but it's two totally different worlds. I dance at a party, but I'm not going to take over the floor. Or it has to be a really hot number that really inspires you, you know. I can't just dance to anything. So it was quite a challenge.
Tina Turner re-recorded her songs for the soundtrack for the film. And you lip-sync. Now, lip-syncing has the potential of looking really phony in a movie. I think you pull it off really well. Were you singing out loud when you were lip-syncing?
Yes, I was. Oftentimes lost my voice. Throughout the film, sometimes you'll hear that raspy quality, and that's actually what happened to her after a concert. So it fortunately, worked for the film, as far as I'm concerned. But I sung along, and just trying to capture all the nuances, the vibrato, the head shake, the mouth, a lot of times you're catching your breath or you're singing with such force, and she's used to it and I'm not, but your mouth would get dry and yet you have to, so your mouth will go into configurations just trying to, salivate, just trying to, get it wet again.
You go through different decades and wear the appropriate clothes and the appropriate wigs. Mm-hmm. Do you think that clothes and wigs have a real transforming effect on you as an actress?
Yeah. When it's right, you just have a feeling like, okay, I'm ready now.
Was there a particular wig or a particular outfit that made you really feel the part?
Oh, yeah. And that one was the rag dress.
Right.
Brown leather rag dress and that brown hair and the heels, I put that on and I just had to laugh because it was like, oh, I look just like her. I look so great, And
I'm sure you dress like that all the time.
Oh, yes. And can you imagine? We had a big crowd that day for the Proud Mary sequence and just walking on stage. I would just put the robe on, for the reveal, And people just went wild just on that look, And I, they saw me every day or whatever and really complimentary. But that particular outfit that day, people just went crazy.
There's a scene in What's Love Got to Do with It in which Tina is recording at the home studio.
Yes.
And Ike's just like not satisfied. He's not satisfied. He's really very jealous of her. And he basically, slaps her around and then rapes her.
Yes.
Did you talk that scene through with Larry Fishburne before doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how you work that scene out?
I remember that day. I was just really nervous, about that scene because you don't know how it's going to be filmed. You don't know how it's going to come across. You don't know with what care is going to be taken. There weren't storyboards, which are sort of like a little cartoon, and you can see what each shot will be. There weren't storyboards for this movie, or at least if there were, I wasn't able to see them. I did not see them. I think they had their shots down. They knew what shots they wanted to get, but it wasn't plotted that way. And some directors like to do it that way, and some directors don't. But this was a very sensitive scene. How much do they want to see? How much will be seen? Well, we actually can't show a rape. It's not that. I remember calling my agent, look, I'm not doing any nudity or whatever. And she wasn't concerned, but I was because we hadn't talked about it. So, I told in the script, it was written that she is raped from behind. And it was just something about that. That act is just so brutal in and of itself. And I spoke to Larry. And I don't know how it was done, how it actually happened, but that image I was against. And, and I told Larry that I was concerned and I didn't want it to be done that way. And he was in agreement with me. He was just there to support me and to, and to make me happy. And then he would say, well, tell them, tell the director, tell the producer that you don't agree with that and you're not going to do it that way. And also, tell them how many times you want to do this scene because it's just emotionally wrenching. And I'm nervous. Oh, what do you mean tell? Now, Larry, you've done a million movies. You can tell them. But, you know, but when it came time to do that scene, I sometimes you just get a strength or whatever, and it's like, I don't mean to be bossy or anything, but no close-ups inside the booth, you know. I insisted that they keep the cameras outside of the aquarium, outside of the booth.
This is the recording booth in which the rape happens.
Outside of the recording area. And the only time they open it up was for the slaps and the beginning of that and the records, the tapes, you know, being thrown off.
Were you comfortable with the way the scene worked out?
Oh, very, very.
A lot very of the camera is really on your
because
face.
Exactly. Because the way I saw you wouldn't even have to have a sound. It could just be that image and a heartbeat, beating of hearts. You know, you didn't even have to hear a scream. But I was very pleased with the way it was shot. I thought it was extremely effective because through that aquarium, the image of, you know how it is when you're running through water and you're expending all this energy and you move one inch, you can't move fast enough. And you sort of feel that trap thing, that drowning, just a lot of metaphors between the two. It happened. And I think that, you know, it was shot that way out of, you know, my concern for it. I didn't want the camera. You can't see but so much. It's rated R, but you can't see but so much. And if you get close, it you know, what are you going to see?
Angela Bassett stars in the new film, What's Love Got to Do with It? This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is back from a 2-week vacation. Welcome back, Noah.
Hi, Terry. It's good to be back here at my regular place at the microphone.
Yeah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
On tonight's program, a federal judge in Washington now says the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada cannot be approved without an environmental impact statement first. We'll have a story from Florida about some monkeys that once were runaways. They're now living comfortably in the woods, causing some problems, though. Bob Mondello reviews The Firm. Laura Canoy reports on the continuing issue of violence as portrayed on television. And Tom Cole will talk with guitarist Adrian Legg, and also we'll hear plenty of music.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on CBS, the network presents a documentary that's all about returning. For one thing, it marks the return of CBS Reports, which has been absent for a few years. More directly, it provides a look at two old war horses visiting the scene of an old war. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The special is called Schwarzkopf in Vietnam, A Soldier Returns. The guide is Dan Rather, and the voyage starts like this.
Tonsonet Airport, Ho Chi Minh City. General H. Norman Schwarzkopf and I are back in Vietnam. It's the first time either of us has returned since the war. We both had mixed feelings about coming here. We wanted to return, but were apprehensive, unsure of how the Vietnam of today will play against the Vietnam that lives in our memories.
Part of this CBS report special is self-congratulatory and almost nostalgic. The sequence on the elaborate network of underground enemy tunnels seems put there largely to set up a clip of Dan Rather, 1965 vintage, popping out of one of those tunnels for CBS News. And when Schwarzkopf revisits one of the battlefields where he got wounded, he tells it slowly and dramatically, and almost seems to enjoy reliving it.
There was the enemy right over there. That's the village of Tam Quan. And there's nothing but open rice paddy all the way across the entire front. So what we had to do is literally attack across open rice paddy, and the enemy was dug in all along that tree line across there. Went out the first day, went charging across, got about halfway across, right in the middle, and they opened fire.
Other moments, though, are tougher. And when Schwarzkopf tells about the time in 1970 when he and his battalion tried to traverse a minefield to save a fellow soldier, the tone turns tragic. The documentary includes interviews with other surviving members of that battalion, whose stories are no less powerful. The minefield segment provides a new perspective on the time, during the Gulf War briefings, when Schwarzkopf snapped at a reporter who asked if the minefields there weren't easier to cross than the military had suspected. "Have you ever been in a minefield?" Schwarzkopf asked. The reporter said no, and the general said, "Well, I have, and all it takes is one." Schwarzkopf became a media star, as well as a celebrated military figure, because of his briefings and conduct during the Gulf War. Since then, he's used the media brilliantly. He's written a best-selling book, and on television, has established himself as an expert on military history and strategy. He did memorable primetime interviews with Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer, and he appeared with Charles Kuralt in two excellent CBS News documentaries, one on Pearl Harbor, another on Japanese generals, and became to World War II what Shelby Foote is to the Civil War. In this new documentary, he moves closer to our time, yet even this very subjective documentary is surprisingly objective, and sometimes conflicting. At one point, he says that it is insanity to want to solve your problems by killing each other. Yet at another point, he enumerates the military lessons to be learned from Vietnam in fighting the next war.
Well, of course, the first lesson is there is no such thing as a limited war. If you're at war, you're at war. You're either at war or you're not at war. It's like being pregnant. And you can't go to war with one hand tied behind your back. You can't, piecemeal commitment is the worst possible way to go to war. You can't let it drag on and on and on. Secondly, you cannot ask young Americans to fight if they don't have the support of the American people. I mean, they must have the support of the American people.
In all of it, Schwarzkopf uses TV brilliantly. He comes off, as he did during the Gulf War, as a tough yet compassionate man, a smart leader with a very candid touch. Dwight D. Eisenhower was the first general to use television. Badly, but he used it. But no general since then has emerged as a popular hero because there hasn't been a popular war since then. Schwarzkopf isn't running for any office, but if he ever does, he's got the tools of the trade down pat.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In Bosnia, Cambodia, Somalia, and other countries, the role of UN peacekeeping forces is being redefined. What are these forces up against? What are their guidelines? And what can they reasonably achieve? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brian Urquhart, former UN Undersecretary General. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.